Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In 1939, when John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath was published, it became an instant bestseller and prevailing narrative in the nation's collective imagination of the era. But it also stopped the publication of another important novel, silencing a gifted writer who is more intimately connected to the true experiences of Dust Bowl migrants. In Writing Like the Wind, biography Iris Jamal Dunkel revives the groundbreaking voice of Sonora Babb. It was Babb's field notes and oral histories of migrant farm workers that Steinbeck relied on to write his novel. This is not merely a saga of literary usurping. On her own merits, Babb's impact was profound. We'll learn about her following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In 1939, when John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath was published, it became an instant bestseller and a prevailing narrative in the nation's collective imagination of the era. But it also stopped the publication of another important novel, silencing a gifted writer who was more intimately connected to the true experiences of Dust Bowl migrants. In Writing Like the Wind, biographer Iris Jamal Dunkel revives the groundbreaking voice of Sonora Babb. It was Babb's field notes and oral histories of migrant farm workers that Steinbeck relied on to write his novel. This is not nearly a saga of literary usurping. In her own merits, Babb's impact was profound, and her life and work feature heavily in Ken Burns' documentary, The Dust Bowl, for example. And Writing Like the Wind reminds us the stories we know and who tells them can change the way we remember history. Iris Jamal Dunkel is previously author of a biography, Charmian Kittredge, London, trailblazer, author, and adventurer. She joins us now. Iris Jamal Dunkel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Very interesting book and interesting history, important here. I want to start with your previous biography, Charmian Kittredge, London, the wife of Jack London, right?
That's correct.
Who apparently helped him write his books, but then that fact was written out of history until, I guess, you and maybe some others helped recover that.
That's correct. I had discovered Charmian. I grew up in Sonoma County, where there's the Jack London State Historic Park, and I had visited that park, and I was like, oh, I want to be a writer like Jack London, and I discovered this book by him called The Valley of the Moon. And in it, he has this female protagonist that was so real. You know, I was like, wow, this man can really write women. Well, it turns out that Charmian had actually written that book and written, you know, the parts of the book that are the female voice, this female protagonist. And I didn't realize that until I wrote her biography. And it just really recentered the story of Jack London, you know, someone who was really idolized as a historical figure, to look at who he was through the eyes of Charmian, who was actually college educated, you know, really led him on all the adventures that he went on around the world.
And so, as you write in the introduction to this book, then something great happened after the biography. The Jack London Museum was reconfigured.
Yeah. So after the book, actually before the book came out, they were remodeling Jack London State Park, and I worked as a docent there, volunteer training the volunteers. And so I gave them my manuscript before it was even published, and they used it to remodel the House of Happy Walls. And that is the museum where it's the house where Charmian lived her life after Jack London died. And previous to that, it was just Jack's story. And she had donated the museum with the intention of it being a museum to both of them. And so when they took my manuscript and they added in her story, they made the top level of the house into the Trailblazer exhibit, which was such an honor. And it has all of the things that Charmian did. Like, for example, she went against gender norms, and she rode astride on a horse instead of side saddle because she wanted to ride fast and she didn't want to fall off the horse. And, you know, all of her She wrote four books during her lifetime, along with helping John Lennon write his. And all of that is now featured. So when young girls like myself go to the park, like I had when I was younger, they'll see this female figure as a hero that they can look up to instead of just seeing John Lennon now.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. And so, as you write here, your goal, like maybe it was opened before, certainly is now to uncover this history, right?
Exactly. So seeing that how if I wrote a book, not only would people read it, but it would also maybe influence the way that history was perceived in places like museums. That felt really powerful as a writer. And I thought, wow, what would happen if I kept doing this? And so I dedicated my life to writing the stories of women who have been forgotten. I started a Substack, and I started because I realized I couldn't write enough biographies. There's so many women that have been erased. And I also started working on this next book right away.
Finding Lost Voices. Tell me a little bit about that.
So Finding Lost Voices is my Substack, and it's a weekly blog that I post where I tell the story of a woman who's been somehow forgotten in our history. And they're all different types of women. I have literary women, but I also have like for example, last week was Victoria Woodhull, who was the first woman to run for president, seemed really timely right now. So the idea that, and everyone's always surprised, like I was traveling in North Carolina and I featured the Wright brothers' sister who helped them with their project of being the first in flight.
Victoria Woodhull, suffragist, ran on a suffragist ticket. I'm reading here from your blog, 1872 election.
That's correct.
So, and I had never heard of her. So I guess that's what you're doing, right? Yeah.
Exactly. That's my intention is I love it when I get emails randomly from people and they're like, I've never heard of this person. I'm like, now you have. That's so great. That's the whole, I get emails back from people, have you looked at this person? And it's really kind of gaining momentum as a movement, the idea that don't just take history for what it is, look back at it. And I learned this lesson when I was in elementary school in California. I was taught that there were no more indigenous people in California, that they'd all been eradicated. And I was sitting in a classroom next to people of Pomo and Miwok descent. So I was like, wait, what about them? And so that idea of questioning history, asking it to not be a single narrative, has been in me since I was a very young child. And I'm really grateful for that. And it's given me a way to interact with the world so that I can push back at that narrative, the single narrative, and give us a more realistic version of history, which is it's something that we're continually rewriting and trying to understand.
One of the quotes at the beginning of the book, I'll just read this from Mardell Lesueur. This is a collective history told by people who lived it. Memory in America suffers amnesia. Here the memory is blown from ashes and glows in the city. So memory in America suffers amnesia, especially a kind of spotty amnesia, right? Certain figures get erased.
Exactly. And we have this redundancy repetition that we take what was said before and just take it without questioning it. And so the mistakes get repeated, again and again and again. That idea that history repeats itself, a lot of the reason for that is because we don't actually try to see the whole history. History is written by the people who keep the archives, the people that set it down and there are always other stories that can challenge that and help us understand each of the time periods much more fully. I mean, for example, when you think of what was a woman like in the 1920s, you're not going to think of someone like Charmian Kittredge London, who's challenging gender norms, who's traveling around the world wearing pants and writing books, very comfortable with herself as an intellectual. These are not things that were taught women were like in the 1920s, but women in the 1920s were very much like women today.
Let's talk about Sonora Babb. As I mentioned in the beginning here, John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, of course, iconic. But we haven't known that there was another writer who chronicled, gathered stories from Dust Bowl migrants, right? And was even more connected into these migrants. So you write that you have a connection to your grandmother. I guess was raised in Oklahoma, from which the, you know, Okies so-called came. I guess she stayed, but she knew these people or people like them, right? Your grandmother did.
Yeah. So my grandmother grew up in Oklahoma, and actually did leave. She left during the Dust Bowl.
Ah, okay.
And relocated to Atwater, eventually to Atwater, California, which is in the San Joaquin Valley. In fact, I have family that still lives there today. But she experienced all of this loss that that Sonora Babb was creating in her story. And when I was in high school, I read The Grapes of Wrath. I was a huge Steinbeck fan because he wrote about the place where I was from. I'm from California. And I read The Grapes of Wrath in high school, like most people. And I rushed home to tell my grandmother. I was like, "Grandma, they wrote a book about us." And she was like, that's not what it was like. And I was like, "Well, what are you talking about?" And she's like, "That's not what it was like. He makes us look like victims. You know, that's not what the Dust Bowl was like. That's not what it was like." And she said, "Don't ever talk to me about him again." So I was like, wow, she's really angry. I can't believe she doesn't believe Steinbeck. And, you know, not realizing that, of course, my grandmother knew the truth. She lived it, you know. And it took me decades to come to terms with the fact that this person, John Steinbeck, this author who I had admired my whole life, I was giving him more authority than my own grandmother, who had lived the actual experience of the disaster of the Dust Bowl and lost everything. You know, her family lost everything in that. And she was really, you know, traumatized by it the rest of her life.
Let's go to, by the way, that's I chuckled when I read that. Don't ever mention that book again, she said, right? I guess her big beef was it made her family and others like them. It emphasized their victimhood.
Yes.
That was her big beef. Yeah. She wanted to emphasize that we're survivors, I guess.
Yeah. And also, like, who were they before?
Yeah.
You know, one lesson I learned growing up here in Sonoma County, California, where we've suffered terrible fires, wildfires quite recently, is that you don't judge somebody on the worst day of their lives when a disaster has taken everything for them. You know, who are you on the day that you lose everything? You're not your best self, right? So the idea that when Sonora Babb approached the subject of people migrating from the Dust Bowl, she actually looked at them before. What were they like before the disaster happened, you know, and built in their love of the land, you know, their relationships, their, you know, who they were as people before they lost everything. And so you were invested in them as people before you, before they moved to, they had to leave everything behind and go to California. Whereas in Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, you start with them leaving. I mean, they were already destitute. You don't know who they were before this all happened.
So you call this the biggest natural disaster in America, you know, up to present times, or one of the biggest. That struck me. I guess this all kinds of fades for us, unless your family experienced this, I suppose. Remind us, this was large swaths of several states, right? And their livelihood, their soil was just blown away, right? They lost their livelihood.
Exactly. So the whole swath of the Midwest, it wasn't just in Oklahoma, it was all of the states in that area. In the land runs, these people started farming land with many of them with very little expertise in farming. And they just never rotated crops in the Western way of farming as it was, you know, they just farmed they farmed with as much water as they had. There wasn't a lot of water. It's a low water area, most of those places. And they farmed the land so much that without the prairie grass, without all of the natural elements, the land turned to dust. And the dust storms that were created from this went as far as New York City. I mean, the storms would come and pick up the soil and transport it all the way to Manhattan. You know, it was just devastating once the dust storms began. And so it was partially a man-made natural disaster. And it's something where, you know, this area, I've been to Eastern Colorado, which is part of the this area that's affected, and they've really learned dry farming techniques, and it's a much different area now. So I'm not saying this is still the case. But when this happened, there was no help for any of these people, and people were just starving on their lands. And the banks were kind of sweeping up the foreclosed properties, and big corporations were buying them up. And so this is kind of when the big farming system started. So we went from small farmers to whole corporations owning thousands and thousands of acres at a time.
And so the thousands of people then headed west, right, to unknown future. I don't know what plans they had. Tell me about your grandmother and her family. The destination was always California, was it?
It was. I mean, so people living in these states got a lot of propaganda that was telling them that if they just went to California, there were plenty of jobs there. And so everybody was like, okay, well, why wouldn't we go to California? And so everyone headed to California, not knowing that when they got here, they would be treated like, you know, not human. You know, the way that people talked about the quote unquote Okies, I say it with quotes because my grandmother did not like me to use that word.
Okay.
But when someone was called an Okie, it was a completely derogatory term. It was saying that, you know, these people don't deserve to go to school. They don't deserve to get medical attention. They were banned from all public, you know, establishments, and they were not given work. And so they'd gone from losing everything to being in a place where they were not helped until they found these, you know, the Farm Security Administration set up these camps in California to help give these people a place to go and help them get back on their feet. And they were democracy run. So the idea was that they were helping run these camps as well. And that way they didn't feel like they were, because these were very proud people. They were like, I don't take government help. I'm going to just get, you know, figure this out on my own with my family. And in these camps, they were given food, but they also worked in the camps, and they helped, you know, run, they had newspapers, they had schools, they had all kinds of things going on so that these people could get back on their feet. And then they would collectively find jobs. They would, you know, they would be able to make that step from being a refugee to being someone who could, you know, make a living.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to remember, right? These are refugees in their own country. The people already there did not want to accept them in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and the conversations that, you know, America is still having about refugees is what was going on then. They were, you know, told, you know, politicians would use them as like a pawn in a conversation about, you know, oh, we can't give money to refugees because it's taking away from the real citizens. And, you know, that same conversation that's still happening in California today was happening at that time. And the other myth that came up from, you know, the Grapes of Wrath versus the Whose Names Are Unknown, which is Sonora Babb's novel about this this time period, was that everyone in California who was a refugee, you know, living in these camps was white. And that was not true. I mean, just like in the you know, in California today, it was a multicultural environment. There was, you know, Filipinos, people, Mexican, there were black people. Everybody was going through this together.
What did you say your grandmother had trauma, I guess, all of her life from this, as you would expect. What did she say when she talked about this? What did she emphasize? What did she learn, I guess, and what was the trauma?
Well, the trauma I saw in her actions, my grandmother didn't like to talk about it as much. It's just like somebody who survived a war, you know? They don't like to talk about what happened to them. My grandmother would, like, if we would go visit her 3.5 hours away in the car. And when we'd leave, she would pack the car with so much food, like with a frozen thing of water and all of this food, because she wanted us to be able to make the journey. Like we were going across the country, you know what I mean? She would save everything. She had like little containers of everything stocked in her drawers. This isn't later in life when she was, suffering from dementia. But before that, she was always worried that this was going to happen again, that she was going to lose everything again, even though she was living a comfortable life in Atwater. Her husband was a high school music teacher, and she had a job working for Farmers Insurance, and then she ran a restaurant, and they had a very stable life with 5 kids, but it never that fear never went away from her. And it was really interesting writing this book that I couldn't not hear my grandmother's voice. It was I'm so sad that I didn't engage in this project before my grandmother passed away, because I could have learned, hope, I mean, I don't know if I would have learned so much from her, but it would have been so fulfilling even to let her read, Whose Names Are Unknown by Sonora Babb, to see a different telling of what happened in the Dust Bowl that maybe was closer to the truth that she knew.
Let's take a break. We'll come back, talk more about much more about Sonora Babb. We're talking to her biographer, Iris Jamal Dunkel. The new book is called Riding Like the Wind. That's coming out later this year, I think. You can pre-order.
October 15th. Yes, you can pre-order right
Pre
now.
pre-order. So pre-order that right now. Fascinating book, Riding Like the Wind. We'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour is Iris Jamal Dunkel, who has written an interesting new biography of Sonora Babb. It's called Riding Like the Wind, and you can pre-order that now. In 1939, John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath was published, became an instant bestseller, but now we know that the publication of that novel stopped another important novel, Silencing a Gifted Rider, who is more intimately connected to the true experiences of Dust Bowl migrants, and that is Sonora Babb. And by the way, that's just part of the story. We'll get into some of this other part of the story as well. Sonora Babb befriended Ray Bradbury, Ralph Ellison, entered into an illegal marriage, was blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee. So it's fascinating history. But I want to talk about the Dust Bowl and her book on the Dust Bowl right now. So how did Sonora Babb get connected up with these migrants?
So she came from Oklahoma, Kansas, and Eastern Colorado, and grew up in Eastern Colorado in a dugout on a broom, farming broom corn. So she knew what it was like to live on a farm, and not make ends meet very well. And so when she went, she traveled to she became acquainted with the Communist Party. In 1935, she attended the Writers' Congress, which was the first Writers' Congress where all of the writers came together. And it was a real movement in American literature. And after that, she went over to England with her husband or her partner, who wasn't officially her husband, James Wong Howe, because they couldn't legally get married because he was of Chinese descent. And when they were in England, she went on a trip around the Soviet Union, and she visited these model farms there, in what is now the Ukraine. And she saw that what she saw there, thanks to the propaganda that she was being shown. I mean, it was definitely not the real thing that she saw, but what she saw was a way that farmers could make a living and not starve. Like the idea that you could be a farmer and be supported by the government was something that was like this. She was like, we've got to do something about this. And so when she came back to America, she stopped by, her mom was still living in Kansas, and she saw the dust storms for herself. And she came back to California, to Los Angeles, where she was living, and reached out to Tom Collins, who's the man that started all of these camps up and down California, these refugee camps for people who were suffering in California, who come over in the during the Dust Bowl. And she wrote to him and said, you know, I'd really like to work with you. And she had already begun writing this novel about people who were living in the Dust Bowl area that was affected, and you know, their life before the Dust Bowl, and then was trying to figure out how to write about what it was like after. And so she wanted to work in the camps, and then she could research and find out what it was like for these people now. You know, she wanted to interview them. She was a reporter at heart. You know, she started off as a reporter in Kansas when she was much younger, and was always writing news stories throughout her life. And so she knew what she was doing. You know, she really wanted to go and do research so she could write the second half of this novel correctly. And so she got a job from Tom Collins and ended up working with him, interviewing refugees for the next 9 months. And she took extensive notes, and she worked on her novel and was nearly finished with it, and actually sent chapters from that out to Random House and received a contract from them to publish it. And so she was really excited. It was a huge, it was her first novel, and it was a huge deal to her to be able to write about these people that she had become, she'd seen and become so close to.
How did Steinbeck get hold of her notes?
So I don't know if you have ever noticed, but in The Grapes of Wrath, The Grapes of Wrath is dedicated to two people. It's dedicated to Elaine, who was Steinbeck's wife at the time, who helped him write that book in some ways. And that's a different story. And to Tom Collins, who helped him find the resources he needed in order to write The Grapes of Wrath. So Tom Collins invited John Steinbeck to the camp, and to the, you know, on several occasions. So they had partnered together earlier, and John Steinbeck had written a series of articles, which is now collected in a book called The Harvest Gypsies, about what it was like in these camps and what it was like for these people, how the camps run. It was really great PR for the camps. And so when Steinbeck said he wanted to write a novel about the plight of the migrants, Tom Collins was like, of course, let's do this. This is great PR. Meanwhile, he's also telling Sonora, you got to write a novel about this. You're such an amazing writer. You got to do this. So he's encouraging both of them at the same time, thinking they'd both be able to write books. So Steinbeck came to visit. One day he came to the camps, and Collins wanted to introduce Steinbeck and Bab, and so they went to a cafe, and she shared all of her notes with him, because she was from a communist mindset, the idea that you are going to share your work with other people, and they're going to respect the boundaries of that work. And so he got all of this content, unbeknownst to her, incorporated that content into his narrative. So that when she, Steinbeck went through three versions of writing a novel about the plight of the migrant workers. And it was the third one that he wrote very quickly, which was The Grapes of Wrath. He started it, I think, in late May and finished it in the fall. So it was really fast that he wrote The Grapes of Wrath. And so by the time Sonora Babb finished her work at the camps and flew to New York, took the train to New York to finish her novel, he'd already published The Grapes of Wrath. And within 3 weeks, it was an international bestseller. And she was called into the office of Bennett Cerf, who was running Random House, who founded Random House. And he had cleared his desk of everything, and all that was on his desk was a check. And so when she walked in that room, she knew something really bad was gonna happen. And when she walked in, he was like, I'm really sorry, Sonora, but we can't publish your book. The Grapes of Wrath has come out to huge success, and we can't have two books about the Dust Bowl. It's just really unfortunate because you've written a really good book. There's just too many similarities between these books. And so because of that, she wasn't able to write for at least a year, and she never felt the confidence in that book, even though many people were behind her, and it didn't get published until 20 years ago in 2004.
And as you write in your epilogue, became best-selling book, at least from University of Oklahoma Press, which published it, right? Yeah, and it is out and available. You can get it now, right?
Yes, you can. And you can read it in all different forms. I teach it every semester where I teach.
So I want to talk about that. I want to keep the focus on Sonora Bab, but I don't know. Is this usual? I mean, reading in your epilogue, you talk about how Steinbeck scholars, when they became aware of this, they had to come to terms with this, but it doesn't seem like there's a huge condemnation of John Steinbeck over this. He himself apparently confessed, "Well, I'm a literary magpie. I just, essentially steal from from everywhere." What do you think we should think about this?
Well, I think we should change our mindsets. You know, the idea that everyone seems really surprised when I reveal to them what happened to Sonora Babb, or the fact that Charmian helped write her husband's books. They seem surprised, but then at the same time, a beat later, they're like, "Well, of course, of course." You know, I think the way we need to think about it is, it's important that we know the fact that some of the books that we've put up on these pedestals are not the same thing that we've been told they were. And that when I went to grad school, I was given a canon of works by authors that were mostly white men. And there wasn't really a place in that canon for my voice, let alone people of color, right? And so the idea that representation in literature is really important. And I think it's my job as an author, as a biographer, to find the alternative stories that have been suppressed because we were just looking at it in one way. We were not looking at all the other stories. You know, if we stick to a single narrative in any part of our history, we lose the complexity of history. And so it's the same thing with literary stories. So there are so many stories of, I'm just looking at women, but there are so many stories of voices that have been taken over by other voices. And because those voices were louder, because those voices had, power in some way, the other voices were silenced. And so it's important that we start looking at history in that way.
Should teachers, what's your recommendation? Should teachers, I guess, obviously at least assign whose names are unknown alongside Grapes of Wrath or instead of? What do you
Yeah, that's a
recommend?
really great question. I would have really benefited from having read Whose Names Are Unknown alongside The Grapes of Wrath in high school, because especially here where there's so many people who come from families of Dust Bowl descent, to know that there was a female voice, that there's a book where women have agency, where California was diverse, that is a very powerful thing to read as a teenager. And the fact that I think that, there's a big read program from the NEA, and they have books like The Grapes of Wrath in it. And if they could start pairing those books with other books by alternative voices, like Whose Names Are Unknown by Sonora Babb, then the children that are reading these books would actually see more representation in these stories, and actually get to know these periods of history much better than knowing them just as a single story. Like if I said the Dust Bowl to someone, they think of destitute people who are victims. They do not think about powerful people that have like taken this huge risk and fought until they've survived the worst trauma of their lives. Like this is a story that happens again and again in America, and we tend to not tell it in a way that tells the story of the heroic sacrifices that these victims made.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about much else. I referenced a little bit of that in Sonora Babb's life. Blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee. She knew Ray Bradbury, Ralph Ellison. Couldn't marry the love of her life, I guess, James Wong Howe, because it was illegal. It goes on and on. We're talking with Iris Jamal Dunkel, who's written a fascinating biography of Sonora Babb, who should be better known, and hopefully we're helping to fix that right here. She wrote a novel, which would have come out, I guess, around the same time of Grapes of Wrath, but publisher said we can't have two Dust Bowl novels, so had to wait decades for publication. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access U Time. Tom Williams. We're talking with Iris Jamal Dunkel, who has written a biography of the fascinating writer Sonora Babb. Whose names are unknown is a novel of the Dust Bowl, and her contract was canceled when John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath was first to publish and became a bestseller. But that book is out and available now. You can get it, Whose Names Are Unknown by Sonora Babb. So Iris Jamal Dunkel, let's talk about some other fascinating points in Sonora Babb's life. I want to start maybe with her early life in Colorado. So she was seven when they moved here. They're living in Oklahoma, right? Father, who's a fascinating figure, apparently a baseball player and baker and gambler. He had these. He was mercurial. He said, "Oh, we're moving to Colorado," and they lived in a dugout. And I think we don't understand what that is. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So they, you know, she was completely uprooted. They were living in Red Rock, Oklahoma. And they took the train to Eastern Colorado near Lamar. And her grandfather had already established he was proving up land there. And her father had also bought he couldn't wait to prove up. And so he just bought a parcel of land. And they were living in her grandfather's dugout. And a dugout is literally a hole in the ground, a big hole in the ground that has a roof on it, and you live in the hole. And so it's almost like being in a giant grave. You've got soil walls and a soil floor, you know, and there's lots of critters, and it's really a rugged lifestyle, but it was quite common in Eastern Colorado at that time. And the previous generation, when a lot of land runs were happening, that was the easiest way to build a structure to live in. And you had a requirement of building a structure to live in on land if you were going to prove up.
How did that shape Sonora Babb, do you think, that her time there?
I think it's it haunted her entire life. She wrote almost all the, she wrote so much about this time period. They lived in a, you know, on a property that had no water. And so she and her sister, you know, they're 7 and 5 years old, would have to carry buckets and go fill them 3 miles away. And they, you know, were part of the harvesting, the part of the planting. And they often, you know, would go without food because they didn't have enough money. And so that time was really, she was really close to the environment there as well. I mean, when you're living in a dugout, you're close to the land. And Eastern Colorado, I had to go there in order to write this book because I'd never seen land like this. You know, I'm from California, and it's this very, very flat land. But the sky is so large and beautiful above you, and you can smell, you know, the sage grass. You can, there's geese circling overhead. And the smells of the earth are so powerful there. I can only imagine what it was like to be in that dugout. And so it's the beauty of the place. You know, she was very close to her grandfather there, and they would go on walkabouts where they just walk for hours out in the wilderness of that area. And so she was constantly in touch with the natural environment there, and it haunted her the rest of her life.
So we're skipping a lot. Of course, you'll have to read the book. But her mother, who by the way was 15 when she got married, dad was 25, right? Her mother apparently was very emphasized a lot education for her daughters, right? So mom was instrumental in helping Sonora Babb get into the University of Kansas. She becomes a journalist. Let's take her to L.A. What drew her to Los Angeles?
Well, she knew she wanted to be a writer. You know, she was like, she had come to head with her father, who was a really difficult personality. We'll just leave it at that for now. And so he was a gambler, and she was like, flip a coin. I'm either going to New York or LA. And it was LA is what the coin said. And so she got on a train and went to LA with little preparation. Like she had, you know, her qualifications to write. She had a, you know, she was able to work as a journalist. And so she thought she'd go to LA and become a journalist and then find, you know, in between she would begin her writing career. But when she got to Los Angeles in this time period, 1929, you can imagine it was right when the stock market fell apart, and it was not a good time to get a job in LA, to say the least.
I was interested to learn that she probably could have become a movie star. Irving Thalberg, the boy wonder, the big time producer, saw her and saw something in her and said, I want to make you into a star. And she turned him down.
She did. Yeah. It's hard to imagine. She was really single-mindedly focused on becoming a writer. She'd gone through a lot to get to that point. And Thalberg saw her eating she was out on a date in a restaurant and thought she had the look of a star. He thought she looked a little bit like his wife, and his wife was going to retire. She'd just gotten her first Academy Award. And so,
this is Norma Shearer for those old timey fans. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was, you know, he'd seen something like her in Sonora. And so he had his agent like hunt her down in the office where she was working. And she was like, she didn't know who that guy was. She thought some creepy guy was following her. But then he explained who he was. And so she agreed to go meet with Thalberg. And, you know, he took these photographs of her. You know, they did the sound check, right? They did like the whole portraits, and all of these portraits still exist at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas, where all of Sonora Babb, most of Sonora Babb's archives are. And there's these beautiful like shots of her, glamour shots. And he met with her afterwards and was like, you know, I'm ready to make you a star. And she just wasn't ready to make that deal. She told him, I'm not interested in being a movie star. We don't really know what happened exactly in that room. You know what I mean? And I don't think it was such a glamorous life to be a movie star at that time, that, you know, our idea of what a movie star was, it was a different system. What it was like to be a woman in Hollywood, I don't know at that time, but she walked away from it completely. And it's really like, in retrospect, like soon after that, she's homeless, you know, like she must have been like, what was I thinking? But that path led her towards her life of writing, which was an amazing life.
Mm-hmm. Around this time, she meets James Wong Howe, who I guess was known as James Howe, right? But he was Chinese American, and he encountered a lot of racism.
Oh, he encountered so much racism, and it's really through her courtship, you know, with James Wong Howe that Sonora became exposed to it. You know, she didn't, you know, she grew up when she was in Red Rock in Oklahoma. You know, her father and mother fought a great deal, and she had made friends with the Oto people who lived in Red Rock and whose land bordered Red Rock in Oklahoma. And she'd spend days at a time there. And so Sonora didn't, you know, for her, she didn't see difference in people in the same way that most people of her generation, most white women of her generation, were seeing it. because the people who had been kindest to her in her life were people who were othered in society. And so when she met James Wong Howe, she didn't know what it was like to be in his shoes until they were dating and they couldn't go to a restaurant. They were like, it was completely empty. And they'd be like, I'm sorry, we don't have any tables for you, you know, or people would actually follow them when they're walking down the street and they're, you know, in their car and just be like, you know, shouting these racist things to them for being a mixed couple. And it was just, Sonora couldn't believe it. She was so angry. And James Wong Howe was like, you know, don't worry about it. I deal with this all the time. And she was like, you know, she really couldn't understand how people could think that way about someone just based on the, you know, the color of their skin.
So Bab was, I guess she was a communist. She
yes.
member of the Communist Party. So, so she's not going to be, you know, loved by the House Un-American Activities Committee. She ended up hiding out in Mexico.
Yeah. So it turned out that despite all this racism, that James Wong Howe had an incredible career as a cinematographer. He received 2 Academy Awards for it. And in the 1950s, after World War II, when the House of Un-American Activities started, they started interviewing Sonora and James Wong Howe at their house extensively. And she was really worried. He was graylisted, and she was really worried that he was going to get blacklisted. And so she wanted to disassociate herself with him because she was a Communist Party member. They had both done things, you know, been part of, you know, communism was deeply intertwined with the writers that she was involved with at that time. And so she moved to Mexico. You know, they'd been there to film one of Jimmy's films, Braving the Bulls. And she went back to live with her friends as a way to, you know, take the attention of her off of Jimmy so he could still get work in Hollywood.
Oh, we're coming down just a few minutes left in the conversation. I want to highlight maybe some of the other works from Sonora Bab. Of course, check out Whose Names Are Unknown, for sure. What would you like to highlight from her other works?
Well, she has an incredible memoir called An Owl on Every Post, which is about her time in eastern Colorado, growing up in that dugout. And it is just heartbreakingly beautiful. I highly recommend it.
So she's featured in the Ken Burns documentary, right? So check that out as well, right? That's Ken Burns did, you know, in his research, discovered her and featured her prominently.
Exactly. A woman named Pauline Hodges, who's interviewed in the film, went to the same high school as Sonora Bab in Forgan, Oklahoma. And so she brought up Sonora Bab to Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan, and they added her into the Dust Bowl documentary because they were so fascinated by her life. And when they read Whose Names Are Unknown, it really informed how they made the Dust Bowl documentary. It's really fascinating. Just by, you know, Pauline Hodges telling them that story, it really connected them to this other part of the narrative of what the Dust Bowl was like.
So you write, history is like soil. You must turn it over, till it, to find other hidden stories underneath. That's what you're doing. Is there something you're going on to next?
Well, I'm really focusing my energy on finding lost voices right now so mm-hmm. that I can expand out the people that that I can tell the stories about. And I'm looking for my next subject. So if you know any stories, if your listeners know any stories of women who have been forgotten by history, I'm really interested to learn about them. And they can follow my story on Substack.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you. So you are open to, if somebody has, you know, a forgotten figure that they want to introduce you to, you're open to that.
Of course. Yeah. I think, the thing about these stories is they're not in plain sight. And so the more people I have looking for them, the better. And the more people that are, you know, open to seeing them, the more we're going to change history and be able to make it more inclusive as a subject.
So yeah, definitely check out Finding Lost Voices, and you can I found that by just going to your website, irisjamaldunkel.com, and you can click over, find previous books, this book as well, and other things Iris Jamal Dunkel has written, irisjamaldunkel.com. Definitely check out this new book, Riding Like the Wind. You can pre-order it right now. It's a biography of this fascinating figure we've been talking about, Sanara Babb. And check out Sanara Babb's books as well. Iris Jamal Dunkel, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.